Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Our examination last week of the trespasses of New England Patriots coach Bill Belichick and the context within which they occurred drew some email. Though many New England fans apparently agree with the coach that it's time to move beyond the illegal filming of opposition coaches, which has cost Belichick a $500,000 fine, Paul DeLascia, who hears Only a Game on WBUR, hasn't done so. "I feel betrayed," he wrote. "If I root for cheaters, what does that make me? Sad to say, I think Belichick should go. It's the only way to eliminate the stink." Laura Fromm, who hears the program on WNIJ in DeKalb, Illinois, wrote, "I find it troubling that Bill Belichick should resort to such idiotic measures. It's definitely the sign of a maniacal ego. I had begun to read David Halberstam's book, Bill Belichick, The Education of a Coach, and now I think I'll use the book to steady my wobbly table." New Yorker Sean Jacobs enjoyed Ken Shulman's story about soccer, a.k.a. football, in South Africa, but wrote, "I felt Shulman let John Comitas, the CEO of Cape Town Spurs, attempt to pass off racist stereotypes, such as putting money down a black hole, as perception or facts without properly contextualizing them." Several listeners wrote this week to correct my contention that the Tampa Bay Devil Rays play in Tampa. In fact, as Patrick Brussell and Tom Duffy, among others, pointed out, Tropicana Field is in St. Petersburg. Mr. Duffy went on to twist the knife by suggesting that somebody who covers the New England Patriots should be more sensitive to such distinctions. "I can't imagine that you would tell your listeners that the Pats play in Boston," he wrote. And he's right. The Pats cheat in Foxborough. Play. Finally, Richard Dietrich wrote to respond to my conversation with Matthew Rossetti, the co-author of The Worst of Sports. Mr. Dietrich took issue with Mr. Rossetti's choice of worsts. He thinks Yankee pitcher Mariano Rivera's meltdown in the 2001 World Series was more egregious than Cleveland reliever Jose Mesa's collapse in the 97 series. And now we'll see what happens if the Yankees and Indians meet in the 07 postseason. Meanwhile, visit our website, onlyagame.org, and let us know what you think about the program. You can write us at WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or you can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860.
This ruling is a blow to athletes and cyclists everywhere. For the panel to find in favor of USADA when, with respect to so many issues, USADA did not manage to prove even the most basic parts of their case, shows that this system is fundamentally flawed. I am innocent, and we proved I am innocent.
Thus spoke Floyd Landis through his attorney on Thursday after a panel of arbitrators had upheld the results of a test that showed the presence of synthetic testosterone in his system during the 2006 Tour de France, while simultaneously criticizing procedures at the lab that had run the test. Hence, Landis can no longer call himself the winner of the world's most famous bicycle race. The unfortunate gist of the story of Floyd Landis and the 2006 Tour de France is apparent in another comment Landis made on Thursday after he learned of the decision the arbitrators had made. Landis said that although he was surprised, the panel's decision confirmed his suspicion that the outcome of the hearing may have been a foregone conclusion. He'd supposed that he knew how it would all turn out, but he was surprised when it turned out that way. Mr. Landis, arbitrators, that call you placed to Wonderland has gone through. We have Alice on the line for you. As a result of this week's decision, the people who thought the test results demonstrated that Floyd Landis cheated have reason to think that they are right. But the panel also criticized the laboratory that did those tests. Hence, the people who felt that Landis was the victim of incompetent clowns and that he was railroaded by authorities desperate to reclaim legitimacy for a sport many outside the cycling community have come to regard as beyond ridicule can claim that they were right. Floyd Landis can appeal this week's decision to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. On Thursday, he said of that possibility, "I have to assess whether a system that corrupt is worth subjecting myself to again." He has also advised athletes all over the world to stop giving urine samples, a tactic that would either bring several multi-billion-dollar industries to a halt or find an awful lot of minor leaguers, replacement players, and amateurs suiting up for big league action. Those determined to maintain that settling the Landis case proves cycling is cleaning up its act have already begun to celebrate this week's events. With regard to a sport that has been the victim of athletes who cheat, criminal chemists and doctors, and labs apparently supervised by the Marx Brothers, not to mention paranoid racers locked into personal feuds spiced by drunkenness and threats, the celebration is at best premature. With just over a week remaining in the season, either the Cubs or the Brewers will make the playoffs by virtue of finishing first in the National League Central Division. Thanks to the Padres and the Phillies, there's an excellent chance that the members of the NL Central team that doesn't finish first will have scattered to various golf courses when the playoffs begin on October 3rd. Joining me now from Atlanta, where the Braves are currently hosting the Brewers, is Tom Haudricourt, who writes about the Brewers and Major League Baseball for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Tom, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. We're glad to be here.
The tone of some of what you have written recently strikes me as cautiously pessimistic. You don't like Milwaukee's schedule compared to Chicago's, do you?
Well, they're not similar in any way. The Cubs finish with all losing teams, and not just losing teams, but teams far, far under 500. And the Brewers are in Atlanta this weekend against a team that's very much alive in the playoffs with some very good pitching, and then they finish at home with San Diego, four games with San Diego, which in my opinion right now might be the best team in the National League. Their pitching is some kind of good, and they're really pressing Arizona in the NL West. And unlike most teams in baseball, the Padres have two portals that they can enter the playoffs through, the wild card and the division. And they're equally strong in both options right now.
In the best, or at least the most dramatic, of baseball worlds, the Brewers would be playing the Cubs head-to-head at least three or four times between now and the end of the month. Would the Brewers fans prefer that circumstance?
Oh, I think without any question, because those two teams, every time they get together, they seem to play some type of nail-biting game. They're very closely matched on the field. And it's a real shame that they're not playing each other, because head-to-head competition is always the most thrilling, and you have to be at a Brewers-Cubs game to understand the intense nature that rivalry has taken on since the Brewers went to the National League. The two fandoms of those clubs don't like each other very much, I don't think.
Chicago manager Lou Piniella is famous for his intensity. I think that's the polite word for it. To what extent has Piniella been responsible for Chicago's most recent surge?
Well, I just think he's probably been a little bit of a calming influence. He's been around this baseball block a few times. He has World Series rings, and he knows that it's a marathon and that you got to play the full 162, and that's really been bearing out in the NL Central race right now, because it does look like it's going to go down to the very end.
From your perspective as a guy writing about the Brewers, who has been especially useful in Chicago's climb toward the top of the division?
Well, Soriano's, hit some dramatic home runs for them. They missed him for a while, and they kind of spun their wheels when he was gone. So he seems to set the table for them. But, Aramis Ramirez has gotten some very big hits as well. And they've got a lot of veteran pitching, too. So I don't think it's any one guy, but I do think it was very noticeable that they did not play as well when Soriano was missing.
The Brewers have been no better on the road than the fourth and fifth place teams in the division have been, but they've been by far the strongest home team in that division, much better than the Cubs in that respect. Why is that?
Well, if you come up with that answer, would you please forward it to Ned Yost, manager of the Brewers, because we've asked him 10 ways to Tuesday why that happens over and over, and there's no logical reason for it. Last time I checked, they're sending the same 25 guys on the road that play at home. I don't know if they're getting bad room service or bad wake-up calls or what, but they should have petitioned the league a long time ago to wear their home uniforms on the road, because they need they've needed something to get them going on the road, and it's been a real problem. And if they end up falling short, they're gonna kind of rue the way they've played on the road.
Well, I would think maybe the fans would take some credit. Milwaukee fans must be feeling like they have a heck of a lot to do with the success that the Brewers have had this season.
Well, there's no question. They're going to set an all-time attendance record that was set in 2001, which when Miller Park opened. And that attendance record was strictly due to the new ballpark. That team wasn't very good. This year, it's because of the team on the field. And I've been covering the Brewers for 20 years, and I've always thought that if they ever put a good product on the field, the fans would come out and support them. And they certainly have. And, you know, 2.8 million in a market like Milwaukee, that's an astounding number.
So I gather that fans in Milwaukee are excited and enthusiastic rather than angry that the Brewers blew the lead that they seem to be holding on to so tightly earlier this summer.
Well, yes and no. Ned Yost has been picked apart by critics, you know, who weren't, you know, sure how to behave in a pennant race, I think. The Brewers haven't been in one in a long time. I was doing a radio show earlier back to Milwaukee, and we were talking about, I guess, Terry Francona and Willie Randolph have become stupid in Boston and New York the last couple of weeks, too, as their team loses. And, you know, the Brewers did have a sizable lead, but they're pitching. They lost Ben Sheets, their ace, who's now got another health problem. And during the 6 weeks he was gone, you know, they lost a lot of games. They went from 3.5 up to 2.5 back. And, you know, it doesn't make logical sense that losing one guy would make everybody else play worse, but when it's your top pitcher, I've seen it happen so many times. And, you know, you can't get those games back now. They just have to fight and try to get back on top. But, you know, I don't think anybody expected the Brewers to have a cakewalk to the division title this year, and people kind of waited all year for the Cubs to get going. They did spend $300 million in free agency over the winter, and they didn't do that to finish second.
It's been since 1982 that the Brewers have been in the postseason. Are fans at this point able to look ahead and say, hey, times are good? You know, this is a team that may be in the postseason any number of times over the next decade or so.
Well, I don't think there's any question that this team's going to be good for a while. It's built around a really young core. But, you know, having said that, Bill, when you have a chance to win, you've got to try to do it. So they may have arrived a year early in the eyes of the so-called experts. But, you know, when you have a chance, your fans want to win it now. So the Brewers understand the urgency of that. And when you haven't won for 25 years, you don't want to keep tacking years onto that pile.
Tom Haudricourt covers the Milwaukee Brewers for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Tom, thanks very much for joining me.
Bill, thanks for having me.
The Arizona Diamondbacks host the Los Angeles Dodgers in Phoenix tonight, clinging to a slim lead in the National League's Western Division. The Diamondbacks weren't supposed to amount to much this year, but as Mark Moran from member station KJZZ reports, the Diamondbacks have been winning games in the clutch with lots of players nobody has ever heard of, and they could be baseball's biggest surprise this year.
A few hours before a recent Diamondbacks game in Phoenix, statistics roll on the outfield's big scoreboard, who has the most home runs, the most RBIs, the highest batting average, and the most runs scored. No Diamondback is on those lists, but somehow this group of young players, most of whom you've probably never heard of, have managed to flirt with first place in the NL West all year. Manager Bob Melvin says the team's success has come mostly because the players really believe they can win.
I think the more you go along, the more part of it becomes of you, and if you expect to win and you have some results going forward, success breeds that kind of confidence. So this group has a lot of confidence in each and every member here.
That's the thing that's in baseball. You know, it might be a little bit different than having like a Michael Jordan on your team that can carry your basketball team.
Jeff Cirillo, who turns 38 tomorrow, is a virtual grandpa on this team of young 20-somethings. He likes his team's attitude.
You know, we don't all have a Barry Bonds or an Albert Pujols or an Alex Rodriguez. But, you know, I mean, even the Yankees, when they were struggling, Alex Rodriguez was still doing his thing, you know, but they didn't have the pitching to get it done, you know. So it takes a whole team in baseball to get the whole thing over the course of a season. You know, you need everybody to contribute.
And the D-backs are not only relying on that team spirit to get them into the postseason, they're playing it up.
It's not about your stats or whether you start. It's not even about making headlines. If you don't know what this game's all about, you're not on this team. Anybody, anytime.
The Diamondbacks have launched an ad campaign featuring the voice of reserve first baseman 35-year-old Tony Clark. Now the team's slogan is on T-shirts, bumper stickers, TV, and radio.
Anybody, anytime.
In addition to having become the unofficial public spokesman for the team through these TV and radio spots, Tony Clark sees a twofold purpose to his job as a Diamondback.
I have responsibilities on the field, obviously trying to produce and contribute playing-wise, and I also have a responsibility off the field, trying to do my part in displaying to these young guys what it is to be a big league ball player, what it is to be a professional, how to carry yourself at the ballpark, away from the ballpark. And in anything, obviously, I can offer life-wise. Baseball isn't the end-all. When you have 23, 24-year-old young men still learning their way, you offer what you can from the standpoint of having been there, done that.
Starting right fielder Justin Upton turned 20 a month ago and started the season in single A. But he's made big-time contributions in the big leagues, hitting a game-winning home run earlier this season. He's still learning how to play the outfield and getting used to baseball on the game's biggest stage. But he's close to having those sound bites down pat.
At any given time, anybody can do something great, and you know, to contribute. And we go out and we grind every single day, and you know, we find a way to get it done. And we don't have a bunch of guys who, you know, are gonna, you know, it's just that we play so well together.
Upton and the other 20-somethings, Jeff Salazar, Chris Snyder, Miguel Montero, Chris Young, not the Padre pitcher, Emilio Bonifacio, and a few others you've never heard of, have propelled this team to its best season in several years.
Derek Burns, deep left field, way, way, way out of here.
But the spirit of the team is perhaps embodied best by outfielder Eric Burns. He's also clubbed a walk-off home run this year. He's known for playing full tilt all the time, always dirty. His nickname is Pigpen, rolling over in the outfield after making throws to the plate and hustling out every ball he hits.
You know, that's the way I've played the game since I was 9 years old, and I'm not going to change now and see these young kids come up. And, you know, if they could follow my example, I think that's the best thing I could do. More than any words I could say, to be a leader, I think the best thing you could do is be a good example and let them see that.
While the team has a knack of pulling out close games and a focus that not many young teams have, local sports columnist Scott Bordeaux says the Diamondbacks do have an Achilles heel.
They're hitting. I mean, they're just not a great hitting club. They have the worst batting average in the National League. They don't hit well with runners in scoring position. That said, they've got it done all year long, so who says they can't do it again in the postseason?
For Only a Game, I'm Mark Moran in Phoenix.
Here now to discuss the week's sports news is the gentleman we refer to as the real sports guy, Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill, and hello to our friends at WXXI-HD3 in Rochester, New York.
Excellent. This week, arbitrators decided that Floyd Landis had, in fact, used synthetic testosterone in the 2006 Tour de France. Would you have expected anything different after last May's extremely odd arbitration hearing?
I mean, the whole thing was utterly bizarre. Between the interesting cross-examination of the inexperienced lab technician to the Greg LeMond being apparently blackmailed that his having been abused as a child was going to come out. And given that it was the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, I didn't expect anything different out of this.
Charlie, there has been some dismay among Boston Red Sox fans this week, but I'm happy to say that the possibility of my ideal World Series is still very much in play, and that would, of course, be the Cleveland Indians against the Chicago Cubs. And Cubs manager Lou Piniella has been sounding uncharacteristically optimistic.
Well, we're not speaking because I want Milwaukee to win that division, first of all, but I will grant you a few minutes here on the Cubs because we're friends and we've been doing this a long time. He says looks going to go down the last week of the season, but he said he thought when they got through this week that the Cubs had probably broken through and that the division was theirs for the grasping, which, as you said, is very unusual for Lou Piniella.
In other baseball news, Barry Bonds called the guy who acquired home run ball number 756 an idiot. Why?
Because he paid $750,000 for the baseball, and he's now apparently trying to decide on from his millions and millions of friends online whether to keep it, put an asterisk on it, or blast it into outer space. If blasted into outer space wins, how do you do that if you're not NASA?
The NFL Players Association went before Congress this week, as did Commissioner Roger Goodell. At issue was the union's inability to approve disability claims. This is something that this country's valiant leaders are sure to correct post-haste.
Well, they've been so busy this week condemning newspaper ads that I think certainly they can invest a little time in helping guys with plastic knees and 9,000 plates in their head on this particular issue, which gets worse and worse almost by the month. The NFLPA gets more and more pathetic.
John Kitna, the quarterback for the Detroit Lions, was knocked out of last Sunday's game with a concussion. My understanding is that guys with concussions aren't supposed to go back into the games of the allegedly kinder and gentler National Football League. How did it happen that Mr. Kitna returned to the game?
He said he was okay, which is sort of the system that the new system was supposed to supplant, I think.
I thought so, too.
He cleared up and went right back to normal. He felt it was the hand of God. So when he's 48 and can't remember his way home from the 7-Eleven, he can ask God for directions. This is exactly the kind of thing that the new system was allegedly supposed to prevent. I don't know what to do with these people. They never will understand the fact that you can't ask the player, ever.
Bill Belichick turned over to the league whatever other films he and his staff had accumulated relating to Cameragate or Spygate or whatever you want to call it. Did Roger Goodell's dog eat the damning evidence? It seems to have been destroyed.
Well, this is an interesting conundrum here. All of this material goes back to the very beginning of Bill Belichick's time with the New England Patriots that was supposedly turned over to the league. Now, if there's nothing on it that's against league rules, why destroy it? Why not just give it back to the Patriots? They probably need it. What I think happened here is that Roger Goodell essentially sentenced the Patriots to time served. I think there was a lot on this material. And that, as I said, the Patriots were essentially sentenced to time served.
I wouldn't have thought that there would be a bright side to the story of a National Football League coach being fined $500,000 for cheating, Charlie, but I understand that a dozen tax accountants are ready to say that I'm wrong.
Yes, you can, it turns out, and we have to credit the Tax Prof blog, which I bet you didn't know existed prior to this,
right again.
Prior to this week. They have agreed that the fine is deductible under Section 162 of the Internal Revenue Code. So yes, he can deduct his $500,000 fine.
Philadelphia Eagles quarterback Donovan McNabb said this week, "Everything I say, I expect a backlash from it." And the backlash came after McNabb's contention that black quarterbacks get criticized more harshly than white quarterbacks do. Any truth to this assertion?
I'm sure that it's very real in Donovan McNabb's mind. I don't have any idea how you would prove it empirically. But I do know that the standard for failure seems to be applied more quickly in the case of black quarterbacks than it does in white quarterbacks.
Later today, Toronto FC will face DC United in Washington, Charlie. And my guess is that Toronto's goal...
The company jet is booked. I can't go.
In any case, my guess is that Toronto's goal in that game will be simple, or maybe in this case, that's not the best choice of words.
No, they have not scored in 822 consecutive minutes, which, believe it or not, is an MLS record. That's 822 consecutive minutes is now. You're the soccer guy. How many games is that?
Well, it's somewhere around nine.
Nine games? Did anyone notice that they haven't scored?
Well, their fans presumably noticed. They did, as you might expect in soccer, they did achieve some ties.
Of course they did. You cannot score in 822 minutes in this sport and have a great year.
This morning in Tianjin Olympic Stadium, the U.S. women's soccer team will face Kelly Smith and the rest of the English team in a World Cup quarterfinal match. Have you been watching the Women's World Cup? And if so, what have you found intriguing about it?
Well, I think our gals have a bit of a battle on their hands, to bring the cup back home. I am, of course, interested in the plucky North Koreans who came out of the American group, much to everyone's surprise.
I know Australia is full of wide open spaces, Charlie, but do you think it's a good idea to fill up so much of that wide open space with a golf course?
The world's longest golf course, 1,200 kilometers, which is 750 miles for those of us who don't follow soccer, along a desert. It's going to be built now because the Australian government has gotten in on the act. I don't believe anyone should be able to tee off in one town and finish up in the other. I mean, so you're swinging the club for the first time in Kalgoorlie and you end up in Sedona, which presumably is where the bar is going to be, which you're really going to need after playing on a 750-mile golf course.
A Puerto Rican horse has achieved a distinction of which the horse's trainer can't be proud. Tell us of Doña Chepa.
Oh, man. Are we bumping Zippy Chippy?
I was going to ask whether Doña Chepa was Spanish for Zippy Chippy.
He's 9 years old. He finished last. That's the 125th race he's lost. And Zippy, of course, went for 0 for 100 and got all kinds of publicity out of it. He's a piker compared to this snag.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Far!
Thanks for listening to Only a Game. Please check your local listings for the NPR station nearest you to carry our show, and please visit our website, onlyagame.org.